So I'll go ahead and get started. So if anybody didn't get them, these are the, I should point over here. These are the papers. And what I'm going to do is, I have some movies to show, so I'm going to do that at the beginning. And then I sort of think there's two entirely different ways to look at it, which you get a hint at in these papers. And one is the biology way, which is a lot more about getting the pathway nailed down. And so I'm going to spend some time on that. And the way I want to do that is sort of go through what their argument is. But if anything isn't clear from the biology, I'd like to encourage you just to stop and we can try and I can try and explain or just because it's mainly terminology. And so if I go through it quickly, I may use terminology you don't know. So stop me and get me to define it. And I don't work in this area, but I've been doing some reading and have a little bit of background. So then I'll talk about the modeling, which is Rappel et al. And so Herbie Levine worked on that. Some of you may have already heard some talks on that. There was one at the beginning of the program. So anyway, videos. So this is a neutrophil, which is important in the immune system. And this is a bacteria it's chasing. And these are red blood cells. And so this is...
And that's a single cell?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's one of the sorts of cells that we're looking at.
Things. It's shown at every talk on phenotaxis.
Well, there's just all this waiting.
It's, of course, incredible.
Yeah. This is like, it's from the 50s, this movie.
Yeah, it's from the old.
Okay.
Is that real time?
You know, I actually don't know the answer to that.
Of course, since you don't have the spatial scale.
Last blood test, they told me how many neutrophils I had.
So these are, this is chemoattractant being released from a pipette and neutrophils chasing it. And
these are all cultured. This is cultured.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's one thing here which I think is neat, which is that you can see when they move the pipette, the cell just starts going in the other direction. It doesn't turn around.
The pipette is continuously releasing the...
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Your point is that the cell has a head and a tail.
In this case, it doesn't look like it. If you watch...
Oh, I see your point. Yes, that's right. Okay.
So whatever's closest to the pipette seems to...
Mm-hmm.
Reform.
Yeah. So which is one of the things the biology people get at, that there's... some cases where the cell has a head and a tail, and that's called polarized, and some cases where it doesn't, and it can move in either direction.
They can reform the head and the tail in response.
Right. It can, but when it's polarized, it tends to turn.
Right, change.
Yeah.
In the other case.
Right. So this is a zebrafish wound in an embryo. So this is the wound. Here's a vein. And in a minute, you'll see neutrophils coming out of the vein to go to the wound. There's a whole bunch of them. And this one is greatly accelerated. It's something like 60 minutes compressed to this amount of time.
They come out through the wall of the vein?
You know, I don't know the details about that. But somehow they do. Yeah. So, chemotaxis is important in embryogenesis, a whole bunch of different areas. Embryogenesis is one. So how does a cell has to detect concentration gradients and things and decide which way to go, where it is. Development and growth. One example of how it's important in growth is neuronal growth, like axonal connections and things. Or, you know, if you damage an axon or a dendrite, neurons can regrow parts of them, and they connect often to the correct places. So it's important for that also. And it's like the examples I was already showing are all immune system cells. So it's important in diseases. How does the immune system respond? Here particularly, we're looking at eukaryotic chemotaxis, which is different from bacterial chemotaxis. In bacteria, like E. coli, the mechanism for chemotaxis is different from what we'll see here, in that E. coli are so small that it's hard for them to detect a biological concentration gradient on the size of the scale, or on the scale of the cell, because there simply isn't much variation in concentration. So they have to do it by remembering what the concentration was, and they sort of random walk around, and as if they move to a preferred concentration, if they're moving towards something they like, they realize that they compare it to the old one, and so they reinforce that direction. And if they moved down, they reject that and pick a different direction. So it's a biased random walk. And that isn't what goes on here. I just thought it's interesting. So there's, if you just think about it, there's several possible ways you can detect and respond to a gradient if you're a cell. One is, like E. coli, remembering what it was before and comparing the new value to the old value. Yeah?
I'm sort of slightly lost at the scales. I mean, I always thought that for E. coli, the reason for actually doing the random walk, which usually extends for, you know, great many distances of its body lengths, is it because the ingredients are so small that you cannot actually feel feel that there is a gradient.
That's right.
And it's a random noise. So you have to sample it for a long time. So
that's right.
How can you sample anything with just extending it, you know, to the leg this way or that way? And you will probably, you know, 49% of the time you are going to go the wrong way, basically.
Well, these are a lot bigger. So, like, if you remember that the first movie I showed with the neutrophil compared to a bacteria, the bacteria was really tiny compared to the neutrophil. So even though you're still talking about a single cell, it's a lot bigger, and apparently it can be enough.
So what's the scale? I mean, you know, we know how big a bacterium is, and we know how big a cell is. I mean, a cell is like 10 microns or something.
Mm-hmm.
And what sets the minimum concentration gradient that you can detect over 10 microns? That's a difference in concentration of 10 microns of something, but how do we know?
Yeah, I think
details of receptors or something.
Yeah, I mean, if you work out, I think you can say, all right, we know that some biological, like a biological concentration that's for cyclic AMP that would be a signal that it likes is this value, and here's the minimum it could be, and figure out how many molecules is the difference between those two on the scale of the cell. And if you come up with
there's with concentrations, right? So if you are looking at, say, concentration of, I don't know really what is the concentration of the molecules which the bacteria needs, which are like being caught by neutrophil. But you just need to, I guess, look at the, you know, standard diffusion decay, and then calculate the square root of m errors.
Square root of n over what volume? You're talking the volume of the receptor.
No, I think it's in some papers where people talk that, and I think in the original papers like Purcell or whatever, they basically say that it doesn't really matter. I mean, you have to look at the whole volume of the cell, not just the volume of the
Well,
but the cells, I mean, the not really single molecules, but really a few. And then there's also amplification in the cells. I mean, it's not in every cell which does chemotaxis, but for example, in the dictyostelium squalerum, you have, if you have an input signal, it takes about 4 minutes before the amplification can be measured outside. So you have kind of 4 minutes to memorize. I mean, it's a time measurement in that case. It's not always in bacterial case. I mean, it's not always this delay. But they have, for instance, a typical delay. And I think they suspect that they measure a kind of time.
The argument I think you can make is, if you look at...
There's a light switch over to the right there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so if you have a cell, whether it's a bacteria or... dictyostelium, you can look at for a plausible gradient.
Yeah.
How many more molecules are there here than here?
Well,
so,
of course, I understand.
And so then you can figure out what's the receptor occupancy. And I mean, if the difference is only a couple of molecules, then it's probably unlikely that you can do it. But if.
But the point is, that's the point you're going to have the receptors uncorrelated as well. Time uncorrelated. This is random noise hitting random receptors. And the question is, can you really?
Right. So it takes quite a few molecules. I mean, a big difference between, I mean, more than just a couple molecules difference between here and here to be able to get past the noise. And so a bacteria can't do it, and the claim is that these can. And I haven't looked at anything in detail, but I mean,
presumably
I think
our experiments
people believe that they can.
There are experiments, I assume, where people vary the gradient and find out what the minimum.
Right, but there are different mechanisms, and this tumbling and sampling with these pseudopodia is something that may not have been really verified quantitatively as being the one, but that one is, as it was said, it's relatively random. You just throw these out and expect those to detect the difference, whereas these others, which are the ones that in fact we're going to explore, have much more correlation because of the signals in the cell and the lab.
No, I was just asking whether experimentally one has tested what the minimum.
But whether there is an experiment that actually verifies quantitatively that first model.
So
it might be, there might not.
This in this case. In this case, actually, so this first model, you can make it so that you can treat the cell with a chemical which makes it so it can't extend pseudopodia, which are little projections which it can extend around. So the idea is those could sample for higher concentration. But if you freeze those out so it can't make them, it still can detect the direction. So we know that this isn't the right model.
Well, but there might be cases. One imagines where by turning it off, it doesn't. And so in some cases, that might be the right model.
Yeah, I mean, in fact, in neuronal growth, it's thought that something more like this is the case. So, like, there's a growth cone. And, anyway, I won't go into that. But
I didn't mean to be funny. Go ahead.
So, yeah, so I was gonna say on, so on these... So on this, you are relying on something still where you're detecting a spatial gradient, but you use positive feedback and amplification to amplify that to something sufficient that your cell can respond to it. The third possible one is if you imagine some sort of a signal being sent from somewhere to the cell, it gets to the side closer to the source sooner. And so if you can respond to that temporal gradient, then you can move towards the source. So the big question is going to be which is more right, the second one or the third one. So without further ado, I'm going to plunge into the biology a little bit. And so as already came up, we're talking about Dictyostelium discoideum, which is an amoeba. And It uses chemotaxis to track and consume bacteria during its, I guess, development. So it has different stages in its life, and it does different things at different times. And it also uses chemotaxis to cooperate with other dictyostelium when it's starved. They have some like colony formation behavior and aggregation, and they do some fairly complicated things like forming what's called a fruiting body, which we won't really get into here. So they signal one another and signal one another to aggregate. So the biology paper addresses several aspects of chemotaxis. One is directional sensing, which they define as detecting asymmetric external cues and responding in an asymmetric way. So how do you know which direction is which? And another is polarization, which is a cell assuming a defined front and back. So when a cell is not polarized, like I already indicated when I showed that movie at the beginning, it responds by just going the other direction when the signal changes directions. When it is polarized, it responds by turning around. So in this talk, I'm going to use front for the thing the biologists call the anterior, because it makes more sense to me. So one question is, well, how do we know where the front of the cell is experimentally? And what you can do is what they've done in these few pictures, which is there's certain signals which are localized to the front. Specifically, the cell makes changes to the membrane at the front of the cell. And there's this thing called the pH domain, or pH domain, which is part of various different proteins. pH, for the name of it, is plectrin homology, but which doesn't really matter. But that proteins with this domain bind to the changed lipids in the membrane, which are localized to the front of the cell. The cell makes changes to particular lipids at the front. So you can take that domain, and using transgenics or whatever the appropriate thing is for bacteria, attach it to green fluorescent protein. And so then it will, green fluorescent protein with this domain will stick to those lipids, and you can see where they are. So in this picture, there's essentially they're releasing the signal from pipette 1 in the top picture and pipette 2 in the bottom, and you can see that the signal is localized. So the cell knows where the front is. And in this case, actually, this is a case where the pseudopodia have been suppressed, so you can see the cell looks very round. So the biologists are very interested in what exactly is the pathway. There's receptors, they call it CAR, which detect extracellular cyclic AMP, which is one of the signals that these are particularly interested in. It's what they use to aggregate. They secrete it. Several bacteria will secrete it, or not bacteria. Several dicti will secrete it. Others detect the signal and move towards it. These receptors are uniformly distributed over the cell membrane. So their occupancies follow the exterior gradient. So there's a shallow difference from the anterior to the post, from the front to the back, if there's a shallow spatial gradient. There's
occupancy by what?
Occupancy of the receptor by cyclic AMP. So, like in many pathways in biology, there's this thing called a trimeric G protein, which is coupled to the receptors. And what that is a protein which has three parts, and it's sort of like a switch. The receptor tells it whether to be on or off, and if it's off, it doesn't do anything. And if it's on, it dissociates into three parts, and those three parts go and activate other things. So for one thing, the distribution of that then is still essentially uniform because it's coupled to the receptors. There's nothing to make it be more in one place than another. Since it has three subunits, and each receptor can activate more than one trimeric G protein, so it's a beginning of a possible amplification. And these often in biology start some kind of a signaling cascade. Each different part of them will go and start some other process somewhere else. So it can be, start this whole big process. They often lead to production of cyclic AMP, which happens both intracellularly and extracellularly. The cell will produce it intracellularly, of course, but it lets it out also. And they're often important to what's called inositol phospholipid signaling, which is what I talked about where the cell makes particular changes to the membrane in response to a stimulus. But that's all general stuff. It could, of course, all be different here. But in this case, these, as I already showed, these particular inositol phospholipids are localized and accumulate. As I already showed, you can image them. And in this case, it's one called PIP3, because it's a triphosphate, which is localized and accumulates. And so the big question is, to the biologist, how does it do that? Because you're going from these G proteins, which are not localized, to suddenly you have something which is localized. And so they seem to have...
When localized by that, not localized, you mean it is localized on the membrane.
Right.
It's anywhere on the membrane.
Yeah, and at most you have...
three clumps.
Right.
In addition to being on the membrane, it actually clumps
right,
in
thank you.
Spots on the membrane.
That's right. That's what I meant.
Which is where the gradients are, the concentrations are. Is,
so
front, is it the front?
Yeah, it is. I mean, that's this picture. You're imaging, essentially, where the PIP3 is.
When you say the receptor is activated, you mean it's absorbed some of the CAMP?
Yeah, the CAMP binds to receptors, some of the receptors. And
that means it's activated?
When it does that, they activate. Okay, so in this case, part of how the PIP3 accumulates is there's something called PI3K for the appropriate kinase. And like other kinases, this takes a phosphate group from ATP and attaches it to PIP2, which is the normal thing in the membrane, changing it to PIP3. And there's a phosphatase, P10, which removes the phosphate group from PIP3 and essentially undoes the process. So what happens here is somehow when the receptors are activated and so on, PI3K, which normally isn't attached to the membrane and only does its job when it is attached to the membrane, moves to the membrane, especially in the front. I'll get to the front back in a minute. But it moves to the membrane, and P10 moves away from the membrane. So that means you're going to quit breaking down PIP3, and you're going to produce a whole bunch more of it.
This is all from inside?
This is all from inside.
From inside.
This is the cell responds to the external stimulus by doing this. And the localization is due to the localization of those two things. PI3K moves... attaches to the membrane, especially in the front, and P10 dissociates, especially in the front, and actually attaches more in the back. So somewhere along the line, between the trimeric G proteins being activated, there's a localization, and Devriati sort of just says, I think it's something like, dependent on local excitation and global inhibition, but they don't have a pathway yet, so it's just a general statement. So you can't say too much about it, I guess. And as an aside, this is a little bit important. When there's a uniform stimulus, the cell isn't in a gradient. You just all of a sudden put a higher level of CAMP. The PI3K initially moves to the membrane and produces more PIP3, and P10 dissociates. But after time, P10 reassociates at a higher level than it was before, which actually could be, I think, part of how the cell accommodates to that new signal, because the cell doesn't want to do anything different just because it has more receptors occupied, it's in a higher level of CAMP because there's no gradient. So
that it wants to detect only gradients about a broad range of background averages.
That's right. So
that's an adaptability thing.
Yes.
Yeah. The background could change, and it doesn't want to be, it wants to be free from the average and only respond to spatial gradients about
right. A
range of averages.
Right.
Yeah, presumably it does that because it only has a finite amount of this PI3K, and it either distributes asymmetrically or symmetrically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and also, I mean, I think the fact that more associates after the uniform stimulus is part of how it probably accommodates, adjusts to that higher average. But I
don't understand where the conundrum is. You say G protein is uniformly distributed, but the cyclic AMP isn't, and so it only gets activated non-uniformly.
Right. So,
it
is, but it's not sufficient to localize it only to the front, because at the most on the scale of the cell, you have a shallow concentration gradient.
Yes.
And when you look at this picture, it's not a shallow concentration gradient. It's very localized to the front. So somehow
there's a steep response to a shallow gradient, and that's the
conundrum. Yeah. How does it have a steep response to a shallow gradient? Because you're going from something which, what I mean by the trimeric G protein not being localized is that at most it has a shallow gradient in its activation because it's just coupled to the receptors.
And this localization is independent of how high the concentration is. I mean, you can have the same gradient for different concentrations. Is it because of the threshold, or is it because of?
You mean does the localization depend on where the average is?
Yeah.
It doesn't seem to. I mean, that's
one of
the, I should have defined the term accommodation. Accommodation means it doesn't care where the average is. It just cares about the gradient. It adjusts.
That's one of the.
Mm-hmm. There's actually, on longer timescales, I think there's a fairly complete model for how accommodation works. And that isn't addressed by this paper because they're addressing the more immediate issue of how does it decide which way to go? And I can give a reference for that if you're interested in looking at it. Okay, so
if you looked at the response as a function of the size of the gradient, is what you're telling us in terms of shallow and steep response, is another way of saying that is it's highly nonlinear?
Yeah. So that's why, I guess, one option is amplification of the spatial gradient. I mean, essentially, you have a highly nonlinear response to the spatial gradient, make a shallow one into a steep one.
I don't understand. Why does it have to be nonlinear? It just has to amplify.
Okay, yeah, so you're right. I mean, not really.
Well, but it's nonlinear, it's not a concentration.
Yeah, so
it turns a shallow constant gradient into a varying gradient.
It's a high susceptibility, not necessarily non-linear.
Yeah.
No, I would say It'd have to be nonlinear if the gradient is very spatially dependent.
Well, I mean.
Oh, come on, it turns a gradient like this into a gradient like this, that's linear.
That's linear.
And how do you deduce from that?
Yeah, I don't think you can tell from this conclusively whether it's linear or not, so.
But they had this experiments which are very old, I think even by Debye, which is where they put all kinds of input signals and output, measured the output signals. I don't know, it's from the 70s.
And what do they see? And what do they find?
Yeah, I mean, what they found is, so there is a desensitization. So if you have a theory, I mean, if you have loud noise for a while, you certainly at a certain point say that's background noise, and you get sensitive to a change of noise. It's the same sort of the same effect, whatever.
So that's not so much in terms of the gradient, but what is the level, right?
So they don't care. So if you
right, that's the accommodation.
Yeah.
They were asking what is the shape of the gradient.
Like,
so there's a kind of delay what they found. I mean, that's what I saw except before. They have this kind of, but only in this species, which is very specific. They're not in all ditches, but in this specific discrete, they have this 3 to 4 minutes delay. So if you have an input, it takes, so if you measure input and output, it takes somehow 3 to 4 minutes. It's very specific.
Right.
To let it go out again.
Yeah, there's a model which does that. I mean, which can explain that now.
Yeah, okay.
So, I mean, if you're interested in it, there was a program here in March which had a section on chemotaxis, and the first talk in that gives something about how this model works. And they get the period right. It just sort of comes out.
One more question about this accommodation. So, the statement is, it that solitons care about the absolute average level of chemical period, or if they do not care about the average level of the chemical if that is larger than some threshold?
They don't care about the average level after they have time to accommodate, which has a period of several minutes.
And presumably over some range.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, eventually you're going to screw it all up, of course.
Too small, too large.
Yeah. So, but about the gradient, I guess we don't have good enough data at this point to know whether the response is linear or not. Okay, so somehow there's something going on which makes the response more localized, either just by amplifying the existing signal or by maybe there's a threshold. It's not known at this point. So in this review, then they go on to, all right, once the cell knows what the direction is, how does it decide which way to move? And PIP3, which is localized, once the cell detects the front, also helps to detect actin polymerization. And actin polymerization is important for cell motion. And that's how it moves.
Is that in the bulk now?
In the,
Well, it's...
I should draw a picture again. So the idea is you have your cell, and here is, on the membrane, your PIP3 localized to the front. So now you begin to polymerize actin at that, so sort of in the bulk, but adjacent to the membrane. And so you allow it to extend in the front, and you eventually retract the back, so you depolymerize your actin in the back. So the front gets pushed forward, and the back gets let come forward.
It's still pretty localized in the...
Right, so it's not back here because this actin doesn't need to move yet. This part stays where it is until the back gets up to here. Light. So, the evidence for that again is that there's co-localization. If you screw up the PI3K, you generally screw up actin polymerization. And also, if you disrupt, if you elevate the PIP3 concentration by disrupting P10, you have excess axon polymerization all over the place.
So P10 is the inhibitor in the back?
So P10, when the front is identified, P10 is especially at the back, and so that would, it prevents PIP3 from being at the back. Yeah. So the other main issue they're addressing is how does the cell establish a defined front and a defined back in the cases where it does. And they just sort of speculate about that, that the cytoskeleton may stabilize the asymmetric distribution of components. So part of the question is, you have a concentration gradient, and the cell responds to that, and it may develop a defined front and back such that even when you take away the concentration gradient, it still has a front and a back. And so the answer they're proposing for that is the cytoskeleton stabilizes this asymmetric distribution of these two by feedback. So the PIP3 affects the cytoskeleton affects the PIP3 again, and so it allows it to maintain the localization. It's a hand-waving thing.
Is material migrating from back to front?
You mean, are you addressing the issue of how does the polymerization work?
Here, about the motion.
Yeah.
Not during the motion.
So, you know, I don't know that much about the way actin polymerization works, but my sense of things is that you generally have, like, actin not polymerized sort of all around in the cell. And when it needs to add it, it's adding molecules onto the ends of existing filaments, lengthening them, and taking it off the filaments at the tail. So, I mean, eventually it probably has to diffuse around to get there, but you have it already where you need it in the short term.
Yeah, so it requires conservation, so eventually it diffuses into
But it's not like you have to take this piece.
We have pictures how it's polymerized and
this
branching pushes.
Right. I mean, I've seen those. I didn't think I was going to be talking about actin polymerization. So it's not like you have to take the actin from the back and move it to the front before you can move. Yeah. Okay. So now, essentially, the second part of the talk is on what they're doing to model. And the big question from a physics point of view, because we already talked about a number of lots of different names of molecules, is sort of what's the minimum model that can produce asymmetry? Not what exactly are the models or what exactly are the molecules involved in the pathway. But so they're taking the approach of detecting the temporal response, or the temporal signal, that the signal gets to the front of the cell first, and that's how the cell detects where the front is. But to do that, you have to address the question, well, but the signal also gets to the back, so why doesn't the back activate? So to make this work, you have to have an inhibitory mechanism such that activation of the front keeps the back from activating. So somehow you've got to get a signal to the back. I should draw again here. You have to get a signal to the back before it can get turned on. So you've got your source over here somewhere, and there's a signal coming this way. It gets to the front, and it's also diffusing around the cell. So this starts activating. To keep that from activating, you've got to get it back through the cell, get a signal back through the cell faster than you can get around it.
Or around.
Or around. So you could do it extracellularly, that would be a possibility too.
Or along the
membrane.
Even
no, that's not what they're suggesting. But yeah, along the membrane would work. I mean, this way, I think you have an advantage that the path difference is better.
So along the membrane would probably be much smaller diffusion constant.
Right, because the membrane isn't that fluid. So they suggest that cyclic GMP is the inhibitor. But that's what we'll talk about here. But the validity of the model doesn't depend on that. It just depends on having some inhibitor that can get there. So they ignore the detailed steps of PIP3, PI3K, all that. And model the membrane as three states: quiescent, which is what it is initially, activated, and inhibited. And so they have three densities, and the total density is one. And so they take linear activation at a rate alpha to a cyclic AMP signal. So that describes the cyclic AMP gets there, and the receptor responds by activating the membrane through whatever pathway. There's linear inhibition due to cyclic GMP when it's produced at a rate beta. And there's also spontaneous transition. So on the other side, there's a diagram of that. So you have initially your quiescent state responds to cyclic AMP by activating. When it's activated, it produces cyclic GMP. Activated is also converted to inhibited at a constant rate, so that over time the amount of activated will go down unless there's more stimulus. And the inhibited goes back to, or quiescent goes to inhibited due to cyclic GMP. So this is the model. So,
you never go from activated to quiescent?
Yeah, that's right.
It doesn't just decay back?
Not the way they're doing it, and...
You know why?
I don't know if they said. Seems like there should be a simple reason. Anybody have...
It wouldn't work quite the same, but you might expect some linkage. I think that's what you're saying.
Yeah. Yeah, you have another parameter, I guess. Okay, so this is what I just said on the previous slide. C is cyclic AMP, so that diffuses. G is cyclic GMP. And then you have an additional term at the boundary, which is production of cyclic GMP due to activated membrane. And there's no flux through the membrane in this case. So the way they determine their parameters is they took equal diffusion constants for cyclic AMP and cyclic GMP, which one is extracellular, one is intracellular, so that may or may not be reasonable, but I think the idea was this way they can just come up with some constraints. And then they adjusted their parameters to produce an asymmetric response in response to an asymmetric stimulus. So they just tried to put it in a parameter range where if there's a gradient, the cell responds by activating a front and not the back. Then they adjusted their parameters within that range so that they match the experimental cyclic GMP production. This is the, pointing at my monitor screen, this is the curve they come up with over here. And some things are known that they were able to match, like how big the peak is, how long it takes to reach the peak, and to what value of the peak does it decay after a certain amount of time.
Just the total amount over the whole cell volume.
Yeah. So once they adjusted the parameters that way, then they apply an asymmetric stimulus and look at the response.
How sensitive it is to the parameters?
I'll come to that in a minute.
They show that. He's going to talk about that.
So here, since this is just two views of the same thing, this is the one on the right is at short time, the one on the left is longer times. So I think here you've got cyclic AMP in the front and in the back. So you can see that they're the same shape, pretty much. There's just a short delay. And cyclic GMP here. And here's the response at the front and at the back in terms of activating. So you can go ahead.
Cyclic AMP in front and back are going to actually do the same level.
Mm-hmm.
Which means, in effect, they're not detecting a gradient at all.
Right.
Yeah. Well, it's
tangent. Yeah, no, I understand.
It's all about the fact that you need a time.
This is the earliest arrival.
Yeah, and this is a pulse of, they add cyclic AMP in a particular place.
No, they clamp it. They clamp the corner.
Okay.
They start with uniform, then they clamp the corner at some higher level.
Yeah, but at t equals 0, you have everything was uniform in the cell.
Yeah, and then
okay.
The pulse comes.
Okay. I was thinking it was a pulse, but yeah, you're right.
No, well, there's a pulse in the sense that, you know, there's a diffusive wave coming across.
Right.
But then, since it's a small enough cell, it's just bleaker.
Yeah. So I guess the fact that they don't see any gradient just shows that it's a small cell and no gradient. Let's go.
Yeah, but if you see on the figure on the right, the solid line and the dashed line of CMP at the front of the bag during the first seconds is pretty different.
That's right. So that's how it works.
I'm not denying it. I'm just sort of curious. It's sort of a curious thing.
Yeah.
You started talking about gradients.
Yeah.
Not talking about gradients at all.
But in this model, they don't care about that. I mean, they're not trying to amplify it.
Trying to estimate the difference in the first month's arrival time or something like that.
Yes.
Yeah. So this is the time, a temporal gradient model.
But then again, I mean, returning back to the first question which I asked is, when you're talking about the first arrivals, you should be careful that sort of a single molecule which by accident arrives first and back doesn't screw you up. That's right.
Yeah, so you have to have...
And then when you do not do it with density simulations, right? I mean, you actually have to do it.
Yeah, but you have to
consider
noise. Which
that's a good point.
Which I'm kind of... I mean, they're not doing gradient estimation, which is the first arrival estimation without taking into account discreteness and noise.
Seems very strange, because if there is a constant gradient and the cell has to keep moving, to do it by temporal reaction.
Well, there must be more than this.
It seems small. I mean, if you'd like to walk on a slope, I guess you'd measure the slope and then decide to walk.
Yeah. I mean,
if you're
the one that makes more sense to me is amplifying a spatial gradient, but.
Yeah.
The biology people say, well, it's some combination of all of these. And, I mean, that actually, in a way, might be reasonable because both have some advantage, but how exactly you combine them is not easy, I don't know. It's easy for them to say.
I had several talks where they say that this is the right picture, and I've never been really understood why this is what they focus on.
Right. And I sort of think that even if it is the right description for these cells, it isn't for some others, like maybe neuronal growth and stuff.
Even bacteria, which are 3 billion years small, lower in evolution, what they do, they walk and...
Yeah, we talked about that already.
And then they respond.
No, we talked about that. That's explicitly not...
Yeah, that's not
the
case
here. I know,
but
I'm saying, so they made a strategy which seemed to be more sophisticated, and it doesn't seem right that the cells will have some strategy that they will be so vulnerable to other things that are going on. Especially because they are not really, many cells, amoeba, it's not really something around. But so are they, I don't know, I came later, apologize, but I don't know if you showed the movie, How They Move.
Right.
Yeah.
And
right.
Yep. Okay, so if you take the peak value of this and divide it by the peak value of this, you come up with an asymmetry ratio. How asymmetric is the response? And in this case, it's about 5. So then if you look at the activation of the membrane in the model, just plotting the densities, this is what you come up with. And for comparison, I put down here the experimental again. This is imaging.
Sorry, what are the numbers at the bottom of each square?
Time.
Time.
Yep, so.
In minutes?
Seconds? I'm sorry. Seconds.
And the experiment is one snapshot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, snapshot after response to one pipette, snapshot after response to another pipette.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they. I mean, the experiment didn't do a time course, so they could have, but apparently they didn't. At least Devriatis didn't address it. So there's, I mean, they're sort of similar. You might say that, well, this doesn't have as sharp a cutoff or cutoff as quickly as these do. They are imaging something different, slightly. In this case, you're actually looking at the model, where's the membrane activated? And in this case, you're looking at binding of this pH domain to couple the green fluorescent protein to a changed membrane. So, you know, depends on whether you want to. Everhard has questions about imaging and things sometimes. So.
Yeah.
And also, localization of these could be a threshold event. Only attach or only a change above some value and not, yeah, so could be cutting it off here. Right.
There's no threshold.
No threshold.
Similar to
right, a threshold would certainly help with noise. Yeah. So on the parameters, they try changing all their parameters by a factor of 2 or 5, and essentially they find that they try like 243 sets of different parameters, and they find that for a factor of 2 change in parameters, more than 50% of them, of the asymmetry ratios, are within 10% of the original one. So it's pretty good, I think, although that's only a factor of 2 change, so you can argue about how good it is. And also that the original isn't the maximal asymmetry ratio. You can get better than that. But you also maintain pretty good asymmetry for a wide range of parameter values.
Right. But this asymmetry ratio, as we saw, is something that's realized in the very first instance. And that's what they're addressing.
Mm-hmm.
They're not addressing the issue of they're addressing the issue of the initial response. Now, whether that's...
Yeah, I mean, it sort of gets back to...
They might explain...
Okay. But don't they then use this to draw a conclusion that this also will explain how it moves?
No?
This is, how does it decide which way to go? Yeah. This is, I describe this as, how does it decide which way to go in the first place? And, I mean, the biologist said you have to have something to stabilize polarity of a cell, which is when it does polarize. But you'd also have to have something to stabilize this so that it doesn't just go away. But that would be something downstream. Well, the in their model, the AR is a measure of whether this is occurring. So you'd have to define what AR is.
The ones they choose.
Yeah, they just vary parameters and see how big the AR is. And so what I mean is, this shows the AR, essentially. The AR is measuring the difference between this and this. So
it's probably...
Or this.
At a very early, I forget at what.
Yeah, as soon as it... Right, so it's actually very early.
It's, you can't... Well, over here, you can tell. It's about a tenth on the right. No, the right picture.
Oh, yeah.
It's about a tenth of a second, or mm-hmm.
Yeah, so somewhere in here.
Right, that's it.
Yeah. So what I mean is, as your AR, as you change your parameters and you end up with a lower AR, that just means that there's less difference between this and this. So I don't know if you say the effect disappears when the AR reaches 1 or if it disappears when the AR reaches 2. I mean, it's...
That's the maximum value over the course of the time.
Yeah. So... This is one of their experimental predictions, which is a really good thing about this paper. They make some, this is a good way to disprove it.
An experiment, right? That's the only one.
They, I think they say something about cyclic GMP. No. Yeah, this is the best, this is the real one, I guess. So they suggest giving dual stimulus. You release one signal and release another one somewhere else a varying amount of time later. If you release them at the same time, then neither end will be the front. And if you release them at very different times, the end closest to the earliest one will be the front. And so they measure, I mean, they do it experimentally and predict this shape to the curve.
I would probably want to see how this curve, and not the just the AR ratio, how it changes depending on the parameters, but how this curve changes depending on the parameters.
How robust that is.
And with this curve, is, you know, 50, can change within 50%, and this is not a
remarkable
experimental condition, because as I already said, I mean, the sigmoidal curve is observed by many experiments. How sigmoidal, what does it tell us? That's the question.
Right, but if your model is that it responds to the spatial gradient, it doesn't seem like it should have the same, I mean, there's no obvious reason why it should have the same sort of time dependence. Because it should depend on the spatial gradient established between the two pipettes.
The question isn't necessarily whether this, they're not using this to choose their parameters. They're using this to choose their model, and they say it's not very sensitive to parameters. So if this is not very sensitive to parameters, that doesn't mean that their model is wrong. The question is, if this actually is observed, is it also a consequence of other models? That's the question.
They will probably observe something which does not quite agree with this. It's a sigmoidal curve, but which is somewhat, slightly different.
But in response...
How easy it is to get different sigmoidal curves from this model. And if you can get basically any sigmoidal curve from this model,
you could use it to determine the parameters.
But
the question is, can you get a sigmoidal curve from other models?
Yeah, can
the question, what they compare? They compare this particular two very robust things, front and head and tail, right? You have a cell and it really has to change its motion towards a gradient, what you'd like to see, how it would respond, and that you mentioned before, that if it's more localized or less localized, the activation. So if you trigger it not head and tail, because in most cases, or any model that has to make it move will give you some kind of sigmoid shape. But if you do it, let's say, head and right, how far, how much it would respond to it?
But
this is a
why should a spatial gradient? So if your model is the spatial gradient model, stationary gradient model, why would you have a sigmoidal curve for the time dependence?
When you say spatial gradient, like this, not that they're not separated.
even cell that will sponsor gradient, special gradient. The idea is that you have activation or whatever material imbalance in production or polymerization or whatever between the two forms. Of course, if you don't, the same mechanism, if you don't have a continuous special gradient, but you just induce it temporarily in time, it will give you asymmetry. See, it's not, it doesn't mean that it's two things which are not dependent. It's a time mechanism that happens. The question really, what, how is it established? Is it established by balancing the times only between
right.
the two sides, or by balancing the fact that you have some concentrations?
Right, so I'm saying, if it's established by the fact that it's balancing some concentrations, why should you have a sigmoidal?
So constant, even if it's a constant, okay, we'll talk about it later, but even if it's a constant a concentration, it doesn't mean that it will constantly react, because the way that they usually react to things, they have sort of pacemaker. They don't react all the time.
Right.
So the question is really, what is it sensitive to, or how it is sensitive to if you have a gradient? You know what I'm saying?
Right.
It's not that it's contradiction. The question is, they are saying before, that from this, to draw a conclusion about motion in a gradient, you have to show, or they have to show something else.
Yep. Okay, so this is sort of close to concluding. This, they just said that you don't have to have that much cyclic GMP to inhibit, because you can adjust rates appropriately to make a small amount do it. And again, provided experimental suggestions, there's this dual stimulus. Also, if you screw up production of cyclic GMP chemically, you should get a more uniform distribution of membrane changes. So that should be something you can check. And again, if this model is correct, you shouldn't be able to get directed motion in static gradients.
Can't that be readily tested?
No.
Why?
Because it's very hard to establish
a steady state gradient.
Right, and that's exactly what Everhard is working on.
How do you establish a steady state gradient?
Well, with microfluidics, that's exactly what Everhard is working on. It's extremely difficult.
Well, you feed it at a constant rate and extract it at the other end.
Yeah, that's what he's doing, but it's extremely difficult. In practice, you have to keep these things alive and all that. And that's exactly what Everhard is working on.
This is part of what Everhard is working on. This would be for the dual stimulus. So here are two microfluidic channels. Here are cells in the channels. And these are also cells in the channels. Only in this case, they're being squished into these little channels. And so the idea would be you flow fluid down here, and release signals in this fluid and this fluid at different times to produce your dual stimulus. And you can do that in several ways, one by just flowing it, or the other by caging your cyclic AMP in some organic molecules they have, which break apart when you shoot them with a laser. So the cell will see nothing there until you suddenly zap this channel with a laser, and then you let the cyclic AMP out of the cages and it sees it.
I'm just confused about something.
Okay.
This thing is going to see the static gradient eventually. But in order to establish the static gradient.
It has nothing to do with that.
This is for the dual stimulus.
How do you. Okay, but let me just ask a question which I'm confused about. How do you ever establish a static gradient without establishing it as, say, having some initial time dependence? And how would you ever distinguish between a time dependence and a static gradient?
Well,
you just leave it in the static gradient a long time, presumably, but by that time some downstream events have frozen in the polarization, and you don't know anything.
Can you throw the cell into an already
cells
into an established gradient. That's the kind of stuff.
So Everhard's, here's a way you can do that, which I don't have a picture for, but Everhard's scheme is this complicated way of mixing such that you can produce a linear gradient.
Right.
So you mix your fluid and produce a linear gradient, but you do it with, well, let me draw a little bit of this.
And then you introduce cells.
So you have, right, so you have your two, you have two fluids coming in, and you, I guess you, I'm not that good at drawing a diagram, but you keep dividing them up, and these things mix them. You divide them again, sort of a tree structure, and you keep dividing. And in the, if you do this for a long time, you can get a linear gradient. So then,
this is but a cyclic AMP.
Yeah, so you do this with cyclic AMP, but you do it with caged cyclic AMP. So you have your linear gradient in caged cyclic AMP. Then you put the cell in, and the cell sees none of it.
And then you zap it.
And then you zap it, and yeah.
Okay,
so it's a very clever way to do it, actually.
Very hard to do.
Yeah.
And he hasn't done it.
So, and this is for the dual stimulus, which is, you know, maybe you have some amount of cyclic AMP that's not caged, the same amount in either channel, and some caged, differing amounts in either channel, and you zap at different times. And so this is to show that they can stick the cells in these things now, and they're still working on how to get them not to wash out, but they're making progress, I guess. So, in conclusion, like this, you know, the biology is complicated, and the biologists don't even have the pathways completely nailed down yet, although they're obviously making progress. But simple models can help provide testable predictions, which can help distinguish between mechanisms, even when you don't have the complete pathway, which I think is really useful. But I think also this sort of illustrates how the questions we ask are different from the questions biologists ask.
There's one more question. Again, I don't know if you addressed it before. If you don't have gradients, the cells still move.
If you don't have a gradient, do the cells... Well, yes, but
they
not in a particular
move.
Direction.
Yes,
usually.
But they do move, and I think that this is an important thing of the mechanism. So it's not that it caused the entire movement, but it's sort of guiding the movement, and it's very different, because the cells do move, also in the absence of...
Incidentally, they don't even particularly change their average velocity when they detect a gradient.
Right. So
they change their direction.
In the absence of the gradient, and if you put something, they change the direction, and then they could...
But if you kill their motion, they can still detect the gradient.
What?
You can keep them from moving, and they still detect.
These are two different things. One is the motion, and one is
right.
the detection
right.
of the gradient that then guides the mechanism
right.
of the motion.
This isn't about
and this is absent.
Okay, this isn't about motion. This is about detecting gradient.
Yeah, wait, I'm trying to understand what you said. You made the distinction between polarized and unpolarized cells. And normally the cell would be unpolarized. It doesn't have a big action structure on one side and
right.
rather than the other. But it's still moving.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you can find cells that will not move, or some cells that will move straight, even without
sure.
and never change.
Typically,
that will
these
move
cells,
randomly.
Yeah.
Okay, and what is the mechanism? I mean, I thought the mechanism of motion had to do with that active structure.
Yeah, but I don't have a solution. I'm just saying.
Yeah.
It puzzles me.
So polarized.
Because all these things start from the fact that if you put a temporal gradient,
sure,
special gradient.
You produce the machinery by which the cell moves, and now you're telling me you don't need to do
So polarized doesn't mean you have the actin machinery only going in one direction. It refers to localization of this PIP3 at the front. You can move without having a head and a tail. You can move in whatever direction. You can polymerize your actin in any direction.
And what you're saying is that spontaneously occurs
yeah.
in a random direction.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And
is that understood? No. What sets that off? What sets off? You see what I mean?
It's fluctuations.
Yeah. Fluctuations in water.
Polymerization.
No, so that's a good question.
Not,
I mean, I don't.
Personally, it's hard for me to understand the things before they explain the first thing without any.
Indeed. Yeah.
So I don't know anything about that because I wasn't within the scope of these. But they do go in other directions. I suppose one additional aspect of polarization, which I didn't mention, is that they localize some of the receptors to the front. Not just the response in terms of PIP3, but they also put a higher concentration of receptors at the front when they're polarized.
Receptors flow in the membrane.
Mm-hmm. Which is interesting. Okay. So that's about it. If you want to know more about things along this, there's, you can look on the KITP website, and there were a bunch of talks in March, which are good. And PWID's webpage has lots of good movies. So that's it.
Thanks.